their own way. Did we ever find out how they knew each other? Vikram was friends with Radha's father. She probably sought shelter there. Armand did not like coincidences. Having two people he was hunting turn out to have a connection was no mere accident. Perhaps. And Protector Karna? We've had no further contact since Apura. By contact, Taraba meant that Karna Utara had killed two valuable witch hunters and many Zaga warriors before they'd managed to kill him, or at least that was what Koja's message had said. Though the senior witch hunter had protected himself by adding that he'd been pursuing their primary target at the time, had not himself seen Karna's body thrown into Red Lake, and was going off the Zaga's word, so could therefore not personally confirm the Protector's death. By the time the Inquisitors had eluded Vidal Pursuit and snuck back across the border, he must have floated away. And Rana? Koja is observing the librarian from a distance. She is still Heart of Vidal's guest. More like Heart of Vidal's hostage, Armand mused. That situation could be useful for him, though. If any harm was to come to the lovely young lady, then Devadas the Fearsome would take that as a personal insult and seek revenge. He doubted very much that Harta would survive such an encounter. The heart was a strange and unpredictable thing. But even ambitious men like Devadas had exploitable weaknesses. Devadas already hated Harta because he suspected his involvement in Ashok's fraud, but couldn't prove it. Assassinating Radha while she was in Harta's care would implicate Great House Vidal and surely push Devadas over the edge. That would be an interesting way to get rid of that particular annoyance. Armand would file that option away for later. Something about this situation was troubling Armand, though. I doubt that Vikram would have entrusted his obligation to anyone else, but it also worries me that someone so clever would let himself be recognized in Harbin. I wonder if he is using himself as a decoy to draw us away from the real prize. You think he gave Asura's mirror to Protector Karno? Possibly. Dispatch someone who can change into a fish to check the bottom of the lake to see if it sank with his corpse. Or he might have given it to someone else we do not know about yet. Or perhaps the librarian. He had originally wanted her in his possession so that he could have leverage against the Lord Protector. Armand had originally assumed she was just some woman Devadas had fallen for, because even the ambitious were stupid when it came to love. But with her repeatedly escaping his hunters, it seemed there was more to the librarian than he initially assumed. After all, Devadas must have seen something in her worth forming an attachment. Perhaps Vikram had seen the same thing. I should have Koja find out if she has it.
That will be very dangerous for him, sir. Heart of Vidal has surrounded himself with bodyguards and wizards since the death of his mother. Even a member of the House of Assassins would have a hard time getting in there unseen. If our man is taken alive and exposed as an inquisitor...
A valid point. I will ponder on it for now. Since it is doubtful she even has it, then it is not worth going to war with Heart of Vidal yet. But if she does... Taraba nodded. It was obvious that he was confused and wanted to ask why the Asura's mirror was so important to their mission, but he refrained. If the Grand Inquisitor wanted you to know something, he would command you to know it. The lad understood much of Armand's plans, but not all. Even the most loyal and trustworthy of his allies could never be told what was truly at stake. Taraba was his right hand, but even he could not know what had been revealed to Armand by the demonic prisoner who swam in the tank beneath their dome. It was one thing to plot the destruction and rebuilding of the very fabric of their society,
But Armand doubted even his most steadfast associates would follow him on his mission to enslave their ancient gods. Armand's quest sounded mad, even to himself at times, but he could not deny what he had seen. And in the darkest forgotten corners of Locke, he had laid his eyes upon strange things that no other man alive had ever seen. Was the mirror absolutely necessary to success? Probably not. However, when a man was seeking to become immortal, he used every weapon at his disposal. The Grand Inquisitor inclined his head to look out the window across the darkened desert, deep in thought. Whatever the ancient beings were, gods, as the simpletons thought of them, or simply wizards with abilities beyond anything the world had seen for thousands of years, the ancients had accessed power beyond his wildest dreams, greater than black steel or demon bone, and Armand alone had been shown how to seize it. Rather than answer his assistant's unasked question, Armand began to pontificate aloud. It is understandable that people fear destruction. Upheaval leads to death, starvation, disease, so on and so forth. But in the grand scheme of things, destruction is necessary. Old forest must burn so new trees can grow. Then we cut down those trees to build houses. Then we raise those houses to erect mansions. Every time man builds, first we must destroy. The demons destroyed the old world, and we made a new one ruled by kings. Then we destroyed that world to make the law. Destruction is a bloody mess, but a necessary one. You must destroy one world before you can create a new one. Creation and destruction. One cannot exist without the other. Do you understand, Taraba?
I think so, sir.
Good. Armand reached beneath his seat and pulled out the wrapped package that had been delivered to him earlier. He handed the bundle across to Taraba. This arrived from Akershan a few days ago. Taraba lifted it and discovered there was a solid heft to the package.
What is it?
It is a catalyst for change.
Open it.
Taraba untied the knots, pulled back the cloth, and then examined the thing inside. It was made of oiled steel, carved wood, strips of brass, and danger.
It's some manner of compact fortress device.
Taraba might not have been very familiar with such things, but he was careful to keep the dangerous metal end pointed away from his body as he picked it up by the wooden handle.
Most curious.
It is of a type we've not seen before. It was seized by Devadas right after a rebel used it to kill one of his protectors. It seems that our current criminal infestation has a surprising number of these stockpiled. Most are larger and mechanically simpler, but this one could be concealed beneath a robe, and from what we've been able to ascertain, has a very reliable method of ignition. The others, you need to hold a match to them. This one produces its own sparks when you activate it.
It's so small. Can it possibly be as powerful as the usual ones?
Taraba asked hesitantly. Still powerful enough to open a protector's skull and spray his brains across the grasslands. Taraba carefully turned the device in his hands so as to not accidentally blow a hole in his master's carriage.
Damn those fortress cowards hiding on that island. If it weren't for that narrow strip of ocean, we'd have been rid of them long ago.
Armand smiled. He would have said the same thing himself when he was young and hot-headed. Now, he often suspected that it was the ocean which protected them from the fortress, not the other way around.
regardless of their barbaric ways. Their weapons are deadly, especially in quantity. They make castless rebels the equal of warriors who've trained their entire lives. The law has stopped the proliferation of such things, but everyone knows to be afraid of them. A moment ago, Armand had spoken about the beauty inherent in destruction. By that standard, this device was a work of art. I have a very important assignment for you, Taraba.
Chapter 30. Even though Radha knew she was little more than a political bargaining chip, she much preferred staying in Vidal City to hiding at a goat farm. As the personal guest of Heart of Adele, she was not allowed to leave the grounds of the great house, and she was always being watched by guards. However, it was the most lavish and comfortable of prisons. Harta had an excellent personal chef, and best of all, Great House Vidal had an extremely large library, possessing dozens of unique works, the likes of which she'd never seen before. There were several Vidal histories that had no contemporary in the capital library. There were no copies of any of those there, and she was certain of that, because she'd inventoried and catalogued those sections herself. Perhaps upon her return to the capital, she could arrange for a delegation from the Archivist's Order to travel to Vidal to make copies. While she'd suggested this to Harta, he had seemed completely ambivalent, which would be good enough to secure the agreement. But who was she kidding? As soon as the Grand Inquisitor found a few judges to sign a warrant, she'd be labelled a traitor, and Harta would hand her over to be roasted to death upon the dome. Nobody in the Capitol Library would ever even know these rare volumes existed in Harta Vidal's personal library if that happened. Well, and also, she'd be dead, which was, frankly, a bit more frightening than having an incomplete collection. Despite being her captor, Harta was not a brute. In fact, he was a rather articulate, intelligent, and even charming man when he felt like it. He usually invited her to dine with him, and often had her join him for his evening stroll around the manicured gardens of the great house, where they would engage in pleasant conversations. It sounded almost romantic to describe it that way, but there was nothing romantic about Harta Vidal. If Harta loved anything other than politics, she'd not yet seen evidence of it. Radha had no mind for politics, because politics meant dealing with people, and Radha couldn't really stand being around people. But she had read a great many books on various political subjects, and listened dutifully as her father had tried to teach her about the politics of his obligation, in the hopes that she would someday be given his obligation as head of the Archivist's Order. Thus, she knew enough about the topic to understand that Harta was purely a political animal. He lived for politics, the same way she had lived for books. The nightly dinners and garden walks afterward tended to be Harta and 5 to 7 invited guests, all of high status, but of varying offices, selected based upon their knowledge, importance, and whether or not Harta saw any value to them at the time. The events were really more like business meetings, as the Thakur picked their brains and coldly tried to puzzle out how various issues could be twisted for his benefit. At first, she had been invited to dinner because the topic had been, what is the Inquisition really up to? She had told Harta everything she felt she could, without endangering any of the secrets entrusted to her by Devadas or Vikram, of course, including the Inquisition's attempt to silence her about the true identity of the Castless as the descendants of Remroan and his priests, though Harta had grown bored at the ancient history lesson and told her that he had no time for such esoteric trivia. Afterward, he had laughed and declared her to be a useless academic, knowing everything while simultaneously understanding nothing. However, Harta must have found some of her opinions enlightening, or perhaps amusing, because he had continued to request her presence at dinner thereafter. Radha was fine with this, because living the luxurious life of a Thakur's advisor was better than acting like the prisoner she really was. So she had passed the last month politely giving her opinion on various issues whenever asked, and otherwise keeping quiet. On many topics, she did not have enough experience to have formulated her own beliefs, but being well-read and having an almost perfect memory, she could always recite what others had written about them. Harta seemed to find this useful at times. All Radha could do was hope that when Ormond inevitably sent someone through proper legal channels to retrieve her, Harta might have grown fond enough of her, like a homeless kitten, to intervene on her behalf once again. However, Radha was astute enough to notice that whenever a particularly sensitive topic arose, where the learned men of Great House Vidal needed to discuss something which might put them at odds with Grand Inquisitor Ormond, Radha was not sent for. Which meant that Harta did not want her to know anything that the Inquisitors could interrogate out of her. A very bad sign indeed. Harta had not asked for her company tonight, so the topic must have been one not needing an archivist's perspective. She was fine with that too, because that was one more night she didn't have to socialize and listen to the incessant chatter of first casters sucking up to their thakur. So she'd gotten a plate of fruits, nuts and cheeses from the house slaves, picked a few books from the library, and retired to her nicely furnished guest quarters to read in peace. This life wouldn't be too bad if it hadn't been for the threat of looming doom. If she was lucky, she might just be able to hide out in Vidal, reading books, until Devadas took care of all those criminals and came to get her. There was a firm knock on her door. Radha answered and found a warrior of the personal guard waiting. There were a multitude of men wearing the grey and bronze about the house, but she knew this one personally. "Hello, Luthra."
"Senior archivist."
He was in his dress uniform rather than his armour, but that couldn't fool her. Luthra was a killer. She'd seen that in Apura when he'd dealt with the witch hunter. But killers were her life now. Ever since she'd gotten entangled with the conspiracy against the Castlers, she'd befriended many killers. She even planned to marry one. Oddly enough, she had associated with more killers than librarians in recent months. The bodyguards had been very polite to her on the journey here, and she'd almost started to think of a couple of them as friends since her arrival. Luthra among them, though right now he was all business. "The Thakur has requested your presence in his dining room."
"Oh, he's changed his mind then. Let me grab my sash."
The servants hadn't been able to find her any proper clothing with Capital Library's insignia on it, but they'd at least been able to find her something in the right colours. Even far from home, Radha felt that she should represent her order.
"Of course."
Luthra waited patiently in the doorway for her to get dressed. She went around the corner. Radha really wanted to make sure the Asura's mirror was still properly hidden. She'd squished her satchel far behind one of the wardrobes in the hopes the slaves wouldn't see it when they dusted. She hated just leaving a priceless black steel artifact unsupervised, but Harta had declared her a guest, and guests didn't get searched. That would be impolite. So the privacy of her belongings had been respected so far. On the bright side, if what Vikram had told her was true, whoever was dumb enough to touch it might leave some fingers behind. If Harta found out she possessed such a treasure, he'd be sure to claim the mirror for himself. Hospitality be damned, black steel was worth a fortune. Of course, it was still there, right where she had left it. Face down, obviously. She'd not dare look into it since the first night with Vikram, when she discovered that it wasn't just a mirror, but also a window to something. As she dressed, she called out, "Have you heard anything else from Apura?"
"About your protector, friend? I'm afraid there's nothing new."
Harta's callousness aside, on the road north, Radha had pestered the personal guard about the fate of Karna until they'd relented and sent a message to the men who had chased the Zargar back across the border.
There had been signs of a battle, and a bunch of pulverized corpses, but none of them had been a gigantic bearded man. She fervently hoped Karna was alive, but it was also possible the witch hunters had captured him, or carried off his body. She knew that Luthra had told the garrison commander to send word if they found any trace of poor Karna. Rada checked her reflection in the mirror to make sure her makeup was still good. She normally didn't care about such things. In fact, she rather hated smearing itchy, greasy pigments on her face. Her sister, Daksha, had taught her how to do this, but it had taken Devadas to teach her that she could actually be considered beautiful. She was trying hard to look her best now because Harta seems like the kind of man who would be less inclined to throw away something pretty as opposed to something plain. Satisfied, she walked back into the main room. That was when she noticed that Luthra did not appear to be his normal, jovial self. Of the house guards she'd dealt with most, Garish was the duo one. Luthra was usually upbeat and rather talkative. However, tonight he looked distracted, and perhaps a bit nauseous, as if someone had just delivered some dire news. Her immediate fearful thought was that the Inquisitors were here. But that was illogical. Friendly or not, he probably wouldn't be that upset if they'd finally come to take her away. That would be her problem. "What's wrong, Luthra?"
"There was a dark rumor going around, but it looks like it's been confirmed by a few sources."
He spoke like a beloved relative had died.
"And Gruvadal is gone."
She had to search her mind for a moment to recall who that was. But it wasn't a person at all.
"Your house's ancestor blade?"
"Yes, it was destroyed."
Rada didn't have much first-hand experience with warfare, but everybody knew how amazing and important those rare weapons were to each of the great houses. It was said that a bearer could single-handedly defeat an army, and though she assumed that the historical accounts of such feats had become exaggerated, in warrior terms, they were still a big deal.
"I'm very sorry. Did the criminal Ashok break it?"
That sounded like the sort of horrible thing such a monster would do. The sooner noble Devadas took care of him, the better.
Luthra still seemed to be in shock. "It was lost in battle against Somsak raiders, in some Thau mountain town nobody's ever heard of, back at the beginning of winter. We're just getting details of this now."
This was dark news for Great House Vidal, indeed. A black steel blade was incredibly important, not just for what it was capable of, but for what it stood for. Houses had fallen as a direct result of losing their ancestor blade. No wonder the poor warrior was grieving. The equivalent loss to her would be if someone burned a section of the Capitol Library down. She shuddered at the thought. However, on a purely selfish note, this revelation warned Rada that she'd best tread extra carefully tonight. Harta had been relatively cordial thus far, but he was a powerful man who literally held his fate in her hands, and he was sure to be in a very sour mood now. Luthra escorted her to Harta's personal dining chambers. As the head of the order, her father's estate had been large, even by first caste standards, but it paled in comparison to the magnificence of this place. Great House Vidal was the wealthiest of all the houses, and the Thakur's home was designed to demonstrate that so that all visitors would understand their place. Even though Harta usually spent 3/4 of the year living in the capital, he still maintained an inordinately large number of servants here, and from the way they were bustling about carrying off empty dishes, dinner had already been finished. Rada was a late addition. It was a good thing she'd already nibbled on a plate of cheese. Luthra entered the room ahead of her and announced,
"As requested, Senior Archivist Radamantha Nemstar Harban."
Tonight's dinner topic must have been something relating to the military, because several of Harta's guests were of the warrior caste.
Books had taught her what all the various ranks and medals on their uniforms represented, but you didn't need to be a scholar to tell that these men were of high status. Anybody would have been able to tell that just from the sheer weight of awards they wore. Radha found it funny that the caste which was devoted to such grim duties liked to decorate themselves with more colourful ribbons than Daksha's vapid party friends.
"Join us, librarian."
Harta had a wine glass in one hand, and he gestured for her to sit with his other.
"I have need of you."
In addition to the important military men, the chief house wizard was present, as were a couple of arbiters, all of them reclining on cushions around a low table. It was a warm day by Vidal's standards, so slaves were there to fan them. Luthra took up position with the other guards who were always present, for Harta was rather paranoid about assassins, and Radha moved over by the cushions. Though Radha didn't care for social things, the Capital Library had a great number of very important patrons, so she'd been taught how to always give the proper amount of respect for their respective status. How much respect did Harta rate? There were only 12 Great House Thakurs in the world, and he was the only person keeping her from getting handed off to the Inquisition. So, all of it. She bowed, as was the northern style.
"How may I assist you, noble Thakur?"
"You all need to see this. She has read more books than damnable Ashok has killed men, and she has a memory like a parlor trick. She can remember all of them."
That was an exaggeration, but she wasn't about to correct him. Harta looked a bit flushed, and she doubted this was his first glass of wine tonight.
"I am happy to serve."
"Go ahead, Fonto. Ask her your question. If anybody will know such trivia off the top of their head, it is Radha."
One of the military men nodded, then turned toward her.
"In the history of Locke, how many houses have survived the loss of their ancestor blades?"
That question told her everything she needed to know about the nature of their conversation thus far.
"That's an easy question. The answer is none of them. There are 12, or were 12, remaining ancestor blades spread among the 12 great houses."
Harta snorted. The officers shared a stricken look as the Thakur drank the rest of his wine.
"So we're doomed," muttered one of the arbiters under his breath.
"I'll have none of that foolish talk here," Harta snapped.
The arbiter bowed his head. Harta shook his in disgust, then held up his empty glass so a servant could rush over and fill it.
"Let us be honest. Our ancestor blade has already been lost to us for the last 20 years. This simply seals it. My mother kept on top without it, and I will continue to do so. It was only the naively hopeful that thought Angruvadel would ever return to us from the wicked hands of that fish-eating fraud. Now, Radamantha, you gave the true yet simplistic answer. Now give us the real answer."
"Well..."
She thought about not just the facts, but the facts that Harta would want to hear. Luckily, she had read a book on this very topic once.
"There are 12 swords and 12 great houses in recent years, but there used to be many more black steel weapons in circulation. They have been lost over time for various reasons."
"Like being used by dishonorable scum for dishonorable ends."
The officer who said that looked like he wanted to spit on the floor, but refrained. Which was good, because Harta would probably have killed him for defacing his rug.
"Among other reasons, yes. The sword seemed to have some manner of code, roughly in accordance to the law, but their interpretation remains a mystery to mankind. When they are sufficiently displeased, they self-destruct in a most violent manner, and the owners seldom understand why. It has not always been one weapon per house, but historically speaking, they've been wielded in a wide variety of ways. A house could have multiple or none at all. Even vassal houses had them at times. If a house lost its sword, that didn't mean that the house immediately ceased to exist. Oftentimes, houses continued for generations without a blade before falling. She caught herself. That would not be what they'd want to hear. Or merging with another. Duels have been fought against outsiders who claimed a house's sword and returned it to their own. This is always a possibility because swords require their bearers to accept all honorable challenges to try and claim it.
So I suppose we could just throw our army one at a time into some black steel meat grinder until the sword decides it likes one of us better, said Harter. Brilliant.
Or, in a few notable cases, a stronger house without an ancestor blade has conquered a weaker neighbor who still had one, claimed it as the spoils of war, and made it their own.
Really? One of the officers leaned forward. Such as?
Well, one of the remaining handful, for example. According to Parser's complete compendium of black steel relics, which had been a rather dry and exhaustive read, yet there had never been any mention of Asura's mirror in there either, so perhaps it hadn't been as complete a compendium as the author had supposed. In the year 657, Great House Harban's only sword was broken, but in 668 they defeated Great House Lakshan in a battle in which their bearer was mortally wounded. 40 days after he succumbed to his injuries, that sword chose a new bearer from among the warriors of Harban, and they've held it ever since. There have been others before that as well.
How many? Harter demanded.
4, possibly 5.
Radha did not add that was out of hundreds, and all the more recent examples ended with the newly swordless house eventually being gobbled up and turned into a vassal, like Somsak. Or Vane.
4 or 5. And surely none of them nearly as great as Vidal,
Harter told his dinner party. The Fontos began to nod.
We all know the sword was mostly symbolic. When was the last time my father personally went to war? There are so few ancestor blades left, the great houses never actually use them for anything important, because we're all too frightened we'll break them. They're fickle things, choosing an evil bearer and then getting offended and breaking when it gets used for evil. And Gruvadal deserved to shatter.
It was obvious it made the warriors uncomfortable to hear their Thakur talk so dismissively about the sword. But they weren't about to publicly defend the honor of the thing that had taken the life of Harter's mother. One of them must have been feeling brave, though.
My Thakur, it is true the sword was mostly symbolic, yet it was a powerful motivator to the men. Don't lecture me about symbols, Fonto. I create them every time I give a speech. My words in the capital have done more to strengthen this house than anything Angruvadal has done over the last 2 decades while it was in the hands of villainous Ashok. We may not have an ancestor blade, but we have something that matters far more in these modern times. Money. I can still pay for the biggest army and the most wizards. To the oceans with mighty Angruvadal. Who needs petulant black steel when you can have banknotes instead?
From what Radha knew about warrior culture, that should have been considered low and dishonorable talk. But apparently, to get to such lofty ranks, you needed to be more politician than warrior, so they merely nodded along at their Thakur's drunken boasts.
That said, I understand having a black sword is important to your caste. Mine too. Just the threat of using one bolsters my work in the capital. Even if we never use the damn thing, just the knowledge of its existence grants us prestige. My heart breaks
Not for Angruvadal. But for what Angruvadal's loss means to our house. We are far better off with the sword than without. Hata lingered on that thought. Finally, one of them asked, What do you propose, Thakur? But Al is inferior to no one. We will not stand idle while lesser houses gloat over their treasures. We are Vadal. We take what we want. You heard the librarian. It has been done before. We are far stronger than any of our neighbors. Let us claim one of their ancestor blades. Rada's mouth fell open. Had she just caused a war? The warrior seemed simultaneously excited and nervous about the idea. You speak of no mere raid, but a full invasion, sir. The capital would never approve.
I will handle the capital, Fonto. There's always a pretext for war when you have enough judges as friends. Now we must decide who to invade. All of them have valuable territory Vadal can make a historical claim to. Your assignment is to pick the house we can defeat at the lowest cost. Show me the target, and I will invent their crime against us.
Sir, usually in unrestricted house war, the bearer wouldn't be present. Not just because of the risk, as you've already said, but also because if one side sends an ancestor blade to the fight, then the other side will respond with theirs.
Your point?
With no bearer of our own to counter, our opponent will send theirs. Instead of a contest between warriors, it becomes a magic-fueled bloodbath.
Good. The sooner they send him to the front, the sooner we can kill him and take his sword. Your obligation is to figure out how to accomplish this in the most efficient manner possible. If they do not send their bearer out to play, you will have to simply seize their territory until they have no choice but to send their ancestor blade against you. Vadal does not bide its time. Vadal does not merely survive. We conquer. We take what we want, and I want a new sword. You will give me the report about the best way to do this in 3 days. You are dismissed, warriors.
The members of the militant caste obediently did as they were told. Rada noted that they'd been despondent when she'd arrived, but now there was a fire in their eyes and a quickness to their step. These may have been old men now, but they'd been raised to fight and were still eager for glory. It was in their blood. They will recommend Sonobat, the house wizard said after the warriors were gone.
Of course they will.
Harta set aside his wine and wiped his lips with a napkin.
I'm fine with this. Vokan is the bigger long-term threat to Vidal's security, but their army is strong. We could beat them, but only at great cost. Thau is safe from our warriors' wrath. Though they have the smallest army of our neighbors, their terrain is easy to defend. Whereas Sarnobat's army is smaller than ours, the trade roads make resupply easy for us, and their raids have been a perpetual annoyance which our commanders would love to decisively punish once and for all.
Warriors tend to think with their emotions like that, but in this case, emotions and logistics are on the same side. The solution is so obvious, there isn't really a decision to be made. But I will still let them feel it was their choice. It's good for their pride. It was interesting, Rada thought, that though Harta had appeared to have drunk a bit too much wine while the warriors were here, as he explained the issues of invasion, he did not sound even the least bit tipsy. It had been an act for the warriors' benefit. That emotional caste would expect some manner of reaction over the confirmation of the loss of their sword, and heavy drinking to console yourself was an acceptable warrior tradition. but Harta was of the first. He only cared about results. With this recent and unexpected shipment of black steel, every one of our wizards will be well supplied and ready to strike when the Sarnobat Ancestor Blade takes the field.
That is most generous of you, Thakur. We will be ready.
Excellent. My greatest concern is, should we overcommit our forces against the wolf in the east, will the House of the Monkey see that as an opportunity to claim some of our territory to the west? However, Vokan ambitions are a problem I can stop from the capital. Their merchants need Vidal markets far more than we need their goods. Their workers will not stand for a prolonged conflict. The fools have allowed the worker caste far too much clout in that house. I will use this as leverage.
You are wise, Thakur, declared the arbiter.
The librarian isn't the only one who studies things. I will meet with the bankers and arrange to apply pressure on Vokan. Now, begone. It is time for my evening walk.
The rest of them stood, including Rada, who was still reeling from the idea that she might have inadvertently caused a house war. She already held herself responsible for allowing a genocide.
Not you, Rada. You shall accompany me around the gardens.
She stopped and tried her best to not look nauseous. As they walked from the dining chambers down a hall filled with magnificent paintings of scenes of Vidal glory, with two of the personal guard ranging ahead and two more behind, Harte gave her his arm with a cold smile.
Thank you for your help tonight.
She didn't feel particularly helpful.
I appreciate your hospitality and your protection, Thakur. So I'm happy to assist however you require. But I'm an archivist, not a strategist. I wasn't trying to encourage bloodshed. If that is how you took my information...
Oh, poor naive Rada. We're both of high birth, but you've been so sheltered in your library that you don't truly understand the ways of our caste.
It was difficult to tell with him, but Harta seemed genuinely amused.
First off, never denigrate your ability as an advisor. Your perspective is a peculiar academic one, but such an odd view is sometimes valuable. Second, don't worry. You caused no bloodshed. Well, not this time. The castle's extermination order is clearly on your head. But they're not real people, so their deaths shouldn't trouble your conscience. In this case, I've been looking for an excuse to justify a house war against Sarnobat for ages.
It was like the great weight resting upon her shoulders was taken away, but the one in her stomach, the nauseous, sick, about to be involved in a house war weight, remained.
Then why bring me into it?
My informants tell me that behind closed doors, the warrior caste worries I may be too ambitious and will thus spend their lives frivolously. Warriors have a very narrow view of conflict and can't see the big picture like we can. To be fair, it's because they're the ones doing the bleeding. It helped my grieving leaders to hear the idea of a sword-stealing expedition come from an outside source, where I, like them, merely reacted with all too human passion when offered a spark of hope. They will tell their men that they saw fire in my eyes and steel in my voice, and when a man thinks his Thakur truly cares, he'll fight harder.
Do you? Truly care, I mean.
She honestly couldn't tell.
Harta laughed. Of course I do. I would do anything for my house. But the histrionics and emotion that the warrior caste eat up have no place in the first. We must always be logical, rational, calculating, manipulating. Our obligation requires it. These are all things your father should have taught you.
I think he tried.
Radha did not add, however, that her father was basically a decent, kind-hearted man. Nothing at all like Harter, who she thought would happily drown a sack of kittens in a bathtub if it made Vidal a few banknotes.
That is a father's duty. I have 6 children myself. I have seen to it that every one of them has had the finest tutors. The brightest of them will be my heir. Most will be obligated to various orders to secure the favor of the capital, and to then use their new authority in ways which benefit Vidal. And my dumber children will be married off to other houses to cement alliances.
Such callousness was alien to Radha. She truly loved her obligation. The idea of using her position at the library to benefit Harban, a place she barely knew, was not only illegal, it was incomprehensible. She did, however, understand the part about marrying off the less capable children, though it was a good thing Daksha was so pretty. My father is a good man, Thakur. I am sure he will be greatly pleased that you have treated me with such hospitality and will be sure to remember this favour. He loves his children very much.
I see mine rarely, but when I do not totally dislike them.
Harter rarely spoke about his personal life. She could see why.
That sounds nice,
she lied.
The first caste has no room for frivolity, Radha. Everything, and I mean everything we do, must be for the betterment of our obligation. This persistent management is what keeps Lok strong and prosperous. It is why we are the most important caste. All this beauty, he gestured at the expensive artwork which covered the walls, is not for our enjoyment. It's to establish to our inferiors how important we are, how much better we are than them, so that they will continue to allow us to manage their lives.
And here she was thinking that art was to be enjoyed by looking at it.
What about when people do not wish to be managed?
Chaos, Harter said simply, which is why we must convince them obedience is necessary. The law is necessary, thus we, its administrators, are necessary. Every decision we make must be based upon whether it fosters loyalty from the lesser people or rebellion. The primary responsibility of the first caste is to see to the eternal perpetuation of the first caste.
I thought it was to serve the law.
Same difference.
They walked down the stairs and outside into the magnificent gardens. Colourful birds were nesting for the night in the trees. Insects buzzed, chirped, and clicked. Vidal was blessed with a temperate climate. Everything grew here. Having grown up in the capital, where water had to be shipped in via aqueduct, this much green still seemed alien to her. Sure, the capital had gardens, magnificent ones, in fact, but she also knew that they only existed through great cost and labour. She'd seen the expense reports filed at the library. In lush Vidal, growing things seemed comparatively effortless as far as she could tell. Since it was just the two of them, well, and all the guards, but they were a polite distance away and didn't really count, Radha decided this was her chance to see if she could find out what Harter planned to do with her.
May I ask if you have heard anything else from the Inquisition, Thakur?
I have not, actually. There has been no communication, no warrant, nothing, which is rather interesting in and of itself. Armand put forth a great deal of effort to capture you, but it seems he was only interested in doing so quietly and unofficially. I wonder why.
I don't know.
Another lie. But she didn't dare tell this man about the true nature of her relationship with Devadas. As far as Harter was concerned, she wanted him to believe the protectors were interested in her because she was witness to a crime, and not the beloved of the Lord Protector, whose life could be used to coerce that illustrious man. It must be because they forced me to lie on that report.
Of course. But then I wonder, why not simply murder you? That would ensure your silence. Armand has no shortage of disposable killers who would never be traced back to his order. She could never tell with Harta just how much he actually knew about anything. He must have suspected there was more to her story than she was letting on, but for whatever reason he seemed content to wait rather than just having the secrets beaten out of her. Rada knew that with her complete inability to understand the inner workings of people, she was a lousy example of her caste. But her father had tried to teach her a few things, and one of those was that information was power. And here, she was with a man who had his fingers in everything, so she might as well take advantage of it.
I am baffled, Thakur. What do you think Armand is plotting?
Now that is the question.
Harta stopped to pluck a purple flower from the vine. He smelled it, found it not to his liking, and dropped it on the grass.
The Grand Inquisitor is currently one of the most powerful men in the capital.
I heard he used to be a witch hunter, and that he knows a lot of magic.
Yes, he's supposedly to be supremely skilled at such things, perhaps the best in the world. He's also a man of vile tastes. Last time he was a guest here, one of my servants disappeared. But I don't speak of magical power or murderous inclinations. I speak of real power. He has spent years building a network of contacts the like of which Locke has never seen before. As a collector of secrets and blackmail, a great number of the judges are either afraid of him or wish to curry his favor. His order has become strong, with its hooks into everything. Yet it remains subtle, so as to not draw too much ire. Armand has amassed a great deal of power, but to what end he intends to use it for, I don't yet know. Colourful lanterns were hung everywhere, but there was still a lot of shadow in the garden. Rada didn't quite know her way around yet, so she couldn't tell where they were heading. She'd never been in this secluded part before. The guards in the lead seemed to have some location in mind, though. With Armand being such a force, I am faced with a decision. Vex him, or ally with him?
Rada felt a sudden pang of fear. Would there be a masked inquisitor waiting for them? Was he about to hand her over?
You need to learn to hide your feelings better, Rada. Lucky for you, I have no interest in allying with a spider. My mother had to deal with his plots and made me swear an oath for the good of our house that I would never trust that man. Though I don't yet know Armand's ultimate goal, I very much doubt it will be to Vidal's benefit. Thus he will remain my opponent.
That was a relief.
However, sometimes it is useful to trade with an opponent. Perhaps Armand simply hasn't thought of something suitably beneficial to offer me in exchange for you yet.
Harta chuckled at her discomfort.
I can see what you're doing, Rada. You're trying to play the part of an advisor, trying to make yourself useful to me, so that when the time comes and I am offered a temptation sufficient to trade you, that I won't be able to, because I've come to see you as so indispensable. That's not at all. Spare me, librarian. You've read some history books about political machinations. I'm the man people like you write those books about. Your efforts amuse me. If you wish to truly become an indispensable advisor, then you'd best start acting like one. An opportunity presents itself now. Let's see how you do. They reached a clear area of manicured grass.
A fountain bubbled in the center. Curiously, there were a few other guards already waiting there. Standing between them was a man in dirty, tattered clothing, with shackles on his wrists and a sack covering his head.
What's this?
The next thorny issue I must deal with. How best to rid myself of this criminal without causing too much consternation among the lesser castes? Half of Vadalf thinks of him as a hero. The other half thinks he's a villain. His name is Jagdish. Radha had overheard guards and servants carrying on about this man. Truly, he was the talk of the house. Some heard that he was a foe of Ashok Vidal, others a friend, sometimes, inexplicably, both. Yet all agreed that he was a killer of demons and wizards, and had ridden into Vidal with a caravan full of treasure. Radha hadn't known what to think because his wild exploit sounded like something out of an adventure tale. Right now, I need to decide the most politically expedient way to kill him.
Chapter 31.
You know, lads, the bag over my head is completely unnecessary. I can tell right where we are.
Even blind, Jagdish had felt the turns of the carriage and the thump of its wheels. He knew Vidal's city too well, so he could tell they'd gone to the great house, but not through the main entrance where they'd be seen by many witnesses, but to the quieter back way in. They'd marched him through that gate, and now that Jagdish could hear the fountain, smell the flowers, and feel the soft grass beneath his bare feet, it was obvious they were in the gardens.
"I used to serve here, remember?"
"Silence!" one of the guards warned him.
Jagdish didn't know any of these men. The personal guard had been totally gutted, and everyone replaced after Bedea's embarrassing demise. He'd only gotten the name of one of them, Girish, but that was it, and Jagdish hadn't heard his voice yet. But if Harta was about to pronounce judgment, he needed to know.
"Is Rizaldar Girish on duty tonight? I'd like to know if he kept his word and delivered something to my wife for my..."
The guard punched him in the stomach. The man could hit, too. Made sense. The personal guard weren't just for looking pretty. You had to have proven yourself professional and hard as nails to get this obligation. Jagdish's abdominal muscles hadn't been ready for such an impact, and it left him gasping. His body was already bruised and aching from the several beatings he'd caught in recent weeks. Surprisingly, none from the prisoners, though. Even though he was their former warden, many of Coldstream's captives had been there during the wizard's attack. He'd killed a mighty lot of them during the prison break, but that had been nothing personal. The survivors treated Jagdish like a hero for avenging their lost brothers and cellmates. The prisoners had been terrorized by those wizards that night. They knew what was what. Rather, the beatings had come from the new guards of the Coldstream garrison. After Coldstream's disgrace, every man who had served under Jagdish had been shipped off to other units and replaced with new, unlucky bastards. Since there was almost no chance to earn glory guarding a prison and many opportunities to lose it, the new guards were bitter about their post. They'd taken that bitterness out on the target who was easiest to blame. The current warden had ordered his men not to kill Jagdish, but despite that, he had managed to fall down the stairs a few times now. How very clumsy of him. Most of the new replacements were fine, decent sort, but a few of the warriors had cruelty in their hearts. Giving such men authority over others was a terrible leadership decision, which could only create more problems for the troubled garrison. If Jagdish had been their commander, he would have broken them of such unlawful foolishness. But he wasn't the Rizaldar now, was he? No. He was just another prisoner. Regardless,
Jagdish would remember the cruel guards' faces. And if by some miracle he was ever restored to his caste, he would track those particular men down and demonstrate to them what a real duel looked like. It was amazing the difference when your opponent was actually allowed to fight. Come to think of it, that made two units in a row that had needed complete restaffing after Jagdish had served in them. No wonder he'd gained a reputation for bad luck. Hopefully, the Sons of the Black Sword were still in one piece, but considering he'd not seen them in several months, and they were at war with the whole law-abiding world, that was doubtful. Which was unfortunate, as they were brave men, probably the best Jagdish had ever known. It had been a difficult time for him in prison, not just because of the swift and merciless violence which had been routinely visited upon him, but mostly because of his own ignorance about what was going on outside the walls. He still thought of the Sons as his men, and it was troubling not knowing what was happening without him there to guide them. Ashok was an incredible combatant, a force of nature, really. But his inability to empathize with his soldiers made him a bad officer. Not on purpose, mind you, for despite his dark and well-earned reputation, Jagdish knew that Ashok was a good man, albeit a damaged one. Except you had to have been a regular soldier to understand a regular soldier, which was a difficult task when you were the nigh-unkillable, superhuman, limb-threshing embodiment of the law. He worried all the Sons would die simply trying to keep up with their general. Yet far more worrisome than the fate of his men was the knowledge that he was only a few miles from his wife, and he didn't know what was happening to her. Had Pakpa even heard that he was still alive? Or did she grieve him as if he were already dead? Not knowing was almost enough to break a man's spirit. Well, perhaps a lesser man, but not unbreakable Jagdish. He kept telling himself that as long as he had something to fight for, he would never, ever give up. Though, finding out how Pakpa was doing was the real reason he'd wanted to ask Girish about the delivery of the pocket watch. Being put in the gardens meant that he was either going to meet secretly with Harta himself or someone else of great importance. Jagdish would have a chance to plead his case and ask for mercy. All he'd ever wanted was to be a good soldier and a good leader. It was by cruel twists of fate that he'd ended up sucked into the whirlwind that was Ashok Vidal. One would think that a meeting in an idyllic garden would be a good indicator of leniency, but that assumption would be incorrect. Jagdish knew from personal experience that Bidea had often used the garden as a discreet place for an execution she didn't want in the public eye. Dump a few buckets of water on the grass to dilute the blood, have the house slaves toss the corpse into some castless pig pens, and nobody was ever the wiser. It made sense that Harta would adopt this family tradition from his mother. He heard new voices approaching. It was a man and a woman having what sounded like a polite conversation. There were more footsteps accompanying them as well. Those were wearing boots, and from the creak of weights hanging from leather belts, they had swords. Oh, sure, now the personal guard was allowed swords in the house. He'd had to duel Ashok Vidal with a knife.
Kneel.
Jagdish was roughly shoved down, and the bag was ripped from his head. Even though the gardens were lit only by flickering lantern light, he'd been wearing the hood so long he had to squint as his eyes adjusted. Still, just from the self-assured haughtiness of the shadow standing before him, he knew it was Harta. Thakur of Great House Vidal, and ultimate decider of Jagdish's fate. Jagdish bowed deeply, head near to the grass, and held it for a respectfully long time. Even though Jagdish had been stationed here, he had never really spent much time around Harta. Bidea had been Jagdish's master. In those days, Harta rarely came home and had spent most of his time in the capital, where his gifts best served Fidal. It was said Harta was so good at giving speeches, he could convince a southerner to buy snow. In the few times they had met, Jagdish had found Harta to be unctuous around his mother, while insufferably conceited toward everyone else. But that was normal among the first caste, he had observed. Bidea had been an insufferable hag to work for, but she had been exceedingly sharp. Hopefully, Harta had inherited her wisdom, but not her cruelty. "Rise!" Vidal's most eloquent man merely sounded annoyed. "So you are the warrior who rode with Ashok?" There was no use in lying about it. "Yes, sir. In order to get revenge against the wizard who attacked our house and killed my men. Yes, I did." Jagdish did not look down as he spoke. Dirty, battered, hungry, it didn't matter. He looked his Thakur in the eyes. Let him see Jagdish spoke truth. He had lived with pride. He would die with pride. "You make no excuses for this." "I cannot. I figured I could find them, but I knew I couldn't beat them on my own. I needed help. We tracked them for hundreds of miles, then slaughtered them in their home. When the deed was done, I gathered all the treasure I could carry and brought it here to present to you, my lord. I'm no wizard, but I believe it was rather a lot." Harta surprised him by actually laughing out loud. "It certainly was." He looked to the guards who were flanking them, and they took their leader's mirth as a sign that it was okay for them to find it amusing as well. "I'm amazed at the audacity of this man." Jagdish could see now there was a woman present too. The rather comely young lady wasn't smiling. In fact, she looked worried for him. Jagdish had seen that expression before. It was how the tender-hearted looked upon a condemned man as he was being marched to the gallows, which meant that Harta had probably already told her what he had in store for Jagdish tonight. He didn't want to die. He wanted to fight for his house, lead a command, love his wife, and raise his son. "Thakur Harta, I apologize for any trouble my quest has caused you, but it was something which I was compelled to do. I knew the Black Heart was a criminal, but I needed a criminal to beat a criminal in a land where I could not legally go." "You admit to breaking the law?" "I do. Part of it, at least. But I only did so to uphold the rest." "That was not your decision to make, warrior. Everyone has their place." "My place was taken from me, along with my dignity and my name. I was trying to earn them back." It was plain the way Harta's mirth abruptly ceased that it had never been real at all. "Let me see if I understand. You freely associated with the greatest criminal in the world, the man responsible for destroying our house's sword, who tarnished my family name, who killed my mother, and yet somehow you thought you could just stroll back into Vidal and buy my forgiveness with a wagon full of bones?" "No, sir. I buy nothing. The demons are yours by right. I seized treasure for you because I am a warrior of Great House Vidal. That's what we do on raids." "I should slit your throat right now." "That is your decision to make, Thakur. My life is yours to spend." "You won't beg for mercy." Oh, it was sorely tempting. Sorely tempting indeed. "Warriors are not supposed to beg." "Such dignity, even in rags." "Good. It annoys me when I find cowards among your caste. All your people should be as eager to die for this house as you clearly are." In fact, a large number of your cast have adopted the belief that you are some kind of avenging champion, righting wrongs and collecting heads. That's the only reason you've not already been executed. So, Jagdish's grand entrance plan had worked. Not as well as he'd hoped, but he wasn't dead yet. Take that, Gutch.
You see, Jagdish, I stuck you in that prison in the hopes that the people would forget about you once they found some new shiny thing to distract them. Instead, your imprisonment seems to have had the opposite effect. My informants tell me they're singing songs about you in every warrior's tavern in the city. The man they remember for dueling fearsome Ashok every day, then ran off and turned into a demon hunter. The stories are so outlandish, they're scarcely believable to a skeptical man, but the gullible are eating them up. The warrior's morale has been low since Ashok's betrayal, but in you they have found something to love. Warriors are simple. They like to have their heroes, don't they?
Yes, sir. We do.
However, I can hardly have them making a hero out of someone best known for his disobedience. That sets a dangerous precedent. They're wondering where you've disappeared to, and some of them have begun muttering that your absence is my fault. The malcontents are saying that I am unjust to punish such a hero. I can't, by definition, be unjust, because I'm the one who decides what the law means in this land. Justice is whatever I say it is. Do you understand why such rot is an issue?
Yes, sir. Officers are taught allowing dissension leads to contempt for authority. Contempt for authority destroys the effectiveness of a unit.
In that particular respect, being Thakur was just like being a Rizaldar, only on a far grander scale.
I was warned you are a clever one.
My time is valuable, Jagdish, so I will be frank. I want to kill you. A public execution would send the message that criminals are not tolerated in Vidal, but would further depress my warriors, and the timing for that is very inconvenient. On the other hand, a private killing makes it appear to my caste that I am unconfident, or maybe even afraid of drawing the wrath of the Black Heart.
You could let me live, Jagdish suggested.
Yet, on a personal level, it would please me to see you die, Parter said ever so earnestly. I really want to kill Ashok Vidal, but he's not here.
You are. You're the next best thing.
Would killing you upset him, do you think? Jagdish was trying to be truthful, but that question was making it extremely hard. He swallowed.
I don't rightly know, sir.
Because if given an opportunity to hurt Ashok Vidal, even a tiny fraction as much as he has hurt this house, I would be a fool not to do so. He turned toward the woman.
Don't you think so, Radha?
She seemed to shrink back. The young lady was also dressed in the finery that declared her to be a member of the First Caste, but it was apparent she was uncomfortable with all this life-or-death business.
I don't...
Spit it out, librarian. I've not got all night. Show me that you are worthy of your caste. It is time to make the difficult decisions.
She appeared to be a mousy thing. But there was some steel in her, after all, as she drew herself up to her full, not very impressive bearing, and declared,
If this man won't ask for mercy for himself, then I will do it for him.
Mercy? Ha! Mercy is not good enough.
Harta surprised Jagdish then by kicking him in the chest. On his knees, with his hands bound, there wasn't a damned thing he could do about it. Not that he would have defended himself against his Thakur anyway, because then every member of the guard present would have stuck a sword in him a heartbeat later.
Dust rose from Jagdish's filthy clothing as hard as sandal hid. The Thakur didn't have warrior muscle by any means, but he was a robust man, and there had been a lot of emotion behind that kick, so it still really hurt. Jagdish flopped over onto the grass, grimacing, ribs throbbing.
Mercy is an abstract concept, Radha. The first must deal only in concrete reality. Every decision is a calculation that either benefits or harms our obligation. He kicked Jagdish again, in his already sore stomach this time. You want to prove yourself an advisor? Then advise. What should I do with this man? Somehow, Jagdish's fate had wound up in the hands of some woman he'd never met before. Harta's desires were plain and ended with Jagdish's blood watering the garden. If she was seeking Harta's approval, then the easiest thing in the world would simply be to agree with him and offer a suggestion for a public or private death. Shockingly, the woman did not back down. You spoke earlier of your warrior's perception of your ambitions. You do not wish to be seen as selfish by them, especially as you send them off to war. You can mock my plea, but Chief Judge Samudra Vadal once wrote that mercy is the cheapest investment we can make in the lesser castes, as it costs us nothing, but returns us loyalty tenfold. Quoting one of my own ancestors at me. Sly. Only this investment is not cheap. It requires the sacrifice of my pride, and that is very valuable. I am Thakur. What will people say when they see that I have failed to punish an ally of the Black Heart? They will say I am weak. They will say I am afraid. Harta placed his foot on Jagdish's head and then put his weight down, crushing his face into the grass. It hurt. It felt as if his neck might break, but Jagdish clenched his teeth together and made no sound. Harta extended one hand toward a guard. Give me your sword. The guard drew his blade, flipped it around, and extended it hilt first toward his Thakur. Harta took it, then placed the tip against Jagdish's back. The tiniest bit of pressure was enough to raise blood from the skin. Jagdish prepared to go into the endless nothing.
Wait, there's a way you can take all the credit and none of the blame.
Harta paused in his murder. Go on, Radha.
If showing mercy to this criminal will encourage more crime, just erase his crime.
What?
It benefits your warriors to have a living hero before they go to war. You've got a perfectly good one right here. All you need to do is tell the people that you're the one who made him a hero. Jagdish did not disobey if he was following your orders to track down those wizards the whole time.
You want me to claim that I dispatched this fool on a secret mission?
This time Harta's laugh sounded genuine, because the Thakur wasn't taken by surprise very often. How would that explain his association with the Black Heart?
It's as Jagdish said himself. He used one criminal to get close to other criminals. It's like in the tale of Yasvinda, when the chief judge ordered Yasvinda to pretend to be a bandit in order to infiltrate the lair of the bandit king.
I do not know that history.
It's actually a romance.
I am going to die, Jagdish thought.
But the strategy is sound, Radha hurried. You sent Jagdish on this mission. He may have failed to capture the Black Heart, but he still killed 100 illegal wizards and 12 demons along the way.
With the Thakur sandal crushing his head, Jagdish wasn't about to correct her wild exaggeration of enemy numbers. Then Harta lifted his foot, and Jagdish gasped as most of the pain left his skull.
An interesting ploy, Radha. Because if it was I who sent Jagdish on this quest, then I must share in his glory. The master always receives credit for his servant's labors.
All will say it took incredible wisdom for a ruler to recognize such hidden talents, Radha agreed. Spare this man's life, and you will be mentioned in all the same songs as he is. As for the first caste, they will not think of you as soft, but rather shrewd, because even while your house was reeling, you sent your fiercest warrior to track down Angruvadal. When Jagdish discovered Angruvadal was lost, rather than despair, instead he brought home other magic to replace it. You are a man of action, Thakur. They can hardly fault you for not catching Ashok when all the might of the capital and even mighty Devadas and the protectors haven't been able to catch him either.
Jagdish rolled over enough to see his Thakur's expression. Harta still held the sword and was mulling over what to do with it. And here I was, testing you to see if your naive academic proclivities could be overcome, and if you would be pragmatic enough to suggest how I should best kill this man. And instead, you offered me another possibility, which, though personally annoying, actually does benefit my house. I was too close to this particular issue to see such a simple yet elegant solution. Harta handed the sword back to the guard. That is what advisors are for. Perhaps you can make yourself useful after all.
Well done, Radha.
Thank you, Thakur.
She sounded extremely relieved. Pick him up, Harta ordered. The guards immediately grabbed Jagdish by the arms and hauled him to his feet.
I have made my decision. Do you understand what just happened here, warrior?
I think so, sir.
Do you understand what our story is going forward?
I do, yes.
Do you have a problem with this?
The choice between sharing the glory with an unrighteous fop or bleeding to death on the lawn was an easy one.
No, sir. It was you who sent me on that mission. It was your idea all along. You're very wise.
Correct. If I find you ever say otherwise, then I will be forced to revisit my decision. Now, if I can't be seen punishing you, then I must be seen rewarding you. Harta looked at the guard who was standing by Radha.
Luthra, what do warriors usually do when one of you does something suitably heroic?
An increase in rank and status, as well as corresponding awards for valor, Thakur.
What is the most prestigious of those awards your people can ever get?
The highest award for gallantry in battle is the Paramvir Chakra,
Luthra answered without hesitation, because no symbol was more respected among their caste than the Wheel of Ultimate Bravery.
Did my mother ever grant any of those?
No, sir. It's been a long time since the last recipient. Not since the Siege of Sudarat has one of those been awarded.
Harta turned back to Jagdish.
Then I'll see to it that Jagdish is given one of those. A fitting trophy for a demon hunter.
Jagdish could only stare at Harta and blink.
Getting stepped on had made his head swim less than those words. All of the personal guard were stunned as well. Even though the award was so ancient it dated back to before the Age of Law, before there had even been a warrior caste, the wheel had been awarded only a couple hundred times.